Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. I'm really looking forward to the conversation we're going to have on today's program. Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman have written a phenomenal book. It's entitled Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. And my guest today is Poe Bronson. He's been on this program before, and as you go to my website at albertmohler.com, you will find a lot of material that I reference in terms of his research. I came across it quite unexpectedly. I was reading an issue of New York Magazine, and in it, here was a very brave man making a very brave argument. Poe Bronson was making the argument that the self-esteem revolution is wrong. He was really turning the conventional wisdom on its head, suggesting that this freely offered universals without substance praise for our children was not only not helping them, it was hurting them. And it turns out that children actually have a very strong truth meter, and they actually are very good at evaluating themselves. And when their parents just give them all this praise, where every member of the team gets the same trophy, and you know, you reach this point where every child is praised for everything, regardless of whether the child has even attempted to do well, well, it turns out children see through it, and they assume if they're getting that kind of praise, there must be something wrong with them. Because otherwise, the parent would actually be holding them to a higher standard. That's the kind of counterintuitive thinking we desperately need, because we're living in a cultural moment when there is so much out there, not only related to children, but related to persons of all ages, that is sheer unadulterated secular nonsense. And much of it, from a Christian perspective, falls so far short because it distorts the meaning of what it means to be human by importing all these kinds of ideas that really tell us that what children need, what we need, if we're honest, as parents, is basically self-esteem. And from a biblical perspective, that's a whole lot more of a problem than it is a solution. But now with this new book, Nurture Shock, Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman are out with chapter after chapter, some of the most fascinating stuff. In the interview with Poe Bronson today, you're going to be hearing things such as just adding an hour's sleep to the daily experience of the average teenager can make a difference not only in their academic ability, but also in their state of mind. It turns out that you take 1 hour away, and that's the hour below 7.5 hours a night from the sleep pattern of a teenager, and you have a 50% increase in depression. Now, that's a matter of common grace. God has revealed this to us so that our bodies are telling us something. And that's the something, and this is, by the way, particularly related to adolescence, the sleep pattern of adolescence. Not so important when you reach adulthood, not of the same importance even when they're children. And Poe Bronson explains that in this book along with Ashley Merriman. The most fascinating part of this book to me is the section on lying. And not only does this research indicate that our children, well, they're doing a whole lot of lying, but that we as parents inadvertently can often incentivize lying, and we can often be dishonest ourselves about what a lie is and what we really expect of our children. From a Christian perspective, again, tremendous gain there, tremendous gain in understanding it and understanding our children and, of course, understanding ourselves. You're going to look forward to that conversation, and Poe Bronson will be on with me in just a matter of moments, and we're going to talk about things that really matter. I think one of the most important aspects of this research is that it's not merely the kind of academic research that you'll find footnoted in academic and scientific papers and locked away in some, you know, library vault. This is the kind of research that gives you those aha moments when you can say, I really can make a difference in the life of my child, my children. And there's some grandparents out there that need to, I guarantee you, know what's in this book. And also many, many parents as well. We'll get to that conversation in just a moment. First, I want to talk about something else, and I want to warn you right up front that what you're going to hear in the next few seconds, you've heard over and over again before. You need to hear just these next few seconds in order that we can make a point we really need to make.
There are also those who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegal. It's not true.
Now, as I said and warned, you've heard that many, many times over, because the media have salaciously gone to it again and again and again, and for that reason I avoided it. But I got to tell you, my own conscience has really reached me about not talking about this. And so I wanted to wait a few days intentionally, and let's get away from the salaciousness of the media. Let's get away from the piling on of politics, and let's just deal with what that means for us as Christians. I'm not primarily here concerned about civility and etiquette. Clearly, this was a breach of civility and etiquette. Clearly, this was a misbehavior. And in this case, it was by United States Representative Congressman Joe Wilson, Republican of South Carolina. There's a political context here, and I'm not going to pile on the congressman. He has apologized, and the president has responded by accepting his apology. So why in the world are we talking about it? I want to tell you this. That incident has haunted me, and I think it ought to haunt each one of us. And I just want to plant this little seed in your mind as you think about it. Could it be that each one of us is living in danger of saying just one thing in one unguarded moment of our lives that no one will forget for the rest of our time? See, that's where I right now want to say I grieve for this man, this congressman. He's responsible for what he said. He has taken responsibility for what he said. But the reality is the most Americans did not know of Congressman Joe Wilson of South Carolina until he made that statement, so far outside the decorum of a joint session of Congress. America needs a vigorous political debate. This country thrives on that kind of debate. But we had better learn how to do it respectfully, and not only with the right words, but with the right tone. But it's not just in this context. It could be in virtually any context. I preach and teach all over the place. I take the risk of having this conversation on the air with you 5 times a week. I'm in all kinds of media venues, and I get called upon on short notice to speak to this or speak to that. And I just have to tell you, I'm haunted by this because before God, I want to make certain, insofar as I can possibly make certain, that I would not blurt out, speak out something like this that would be what I become known for the rest of our lives. And so, if you'll allow me, just let me share that exhortation with you. Let's be certain that we do everything within our power, and that first of all means we pray to God to protect us from our own tongues, lest we find ourselves saying something, not necessarily in a joint session of Congress, perhaps in the kitchen, perhaps in the office, perhaps in the sanctuary of the church, where we are remembered for the one thing we said we should never have said. And I've said so many things already that, you know, certainly the biblical warning that our words will trap us, that's always there. We are sinners, it is true, and one of the first places sin comes is from the lips. But in looking at this, it's just a reminder to us that there is always the danger of a large public issue like this that would bring disrepute not only upon ourselves, but far more costly upon the gospel of Jesus Christ. Very interesting article I saw, by the way, in the aftermath of all of this. It had to do with President Obama's openness, as released in an interview with Men's Health magazine, to taxing soda and other sugary drinks. The president said, and I quote, "It's an idea that we should be exploring. There's no doubt that our kids drink way too much soda, and every study that's been done about obesity shows that there is as high a correlation between increased soda consumption and obesity as just about anything else," end quote. Well, I'm sure the president has a very valid point there. But, you know, when you come back to the tax issue, I just want to come back and wonder, would that really solve a problem? I mean, look at the taxes on cigarettes, and they get raised again and again and again. Governments are now dependent upon those taxes, with the perverse result that if people actually stop smoking, which the government says is what it wants people to do, well, the government would have a big financial problem. The taxation issue is never as easy as it appears. It's always more complicated, it's more complex, and it's more morally cloudy than people might first want to think. You know, you could put a tax on sugary drinks, and, you know, for all I know, there could be some merit to the idea. But not only do I suspect the kids would still find a way to drink soda, I think the government would then find an incentive to make certain that people buy these drinks they can tax. In a fallen world, every dimension of politics is affected. And there is no place where you are safe from moral harm. That's why you need to have the checks and the balances of a political process. That's why you do need vigorous debate. And that's why every issue, large or small or in between, requires the scrutiny of many eyes and the craft of many hands in order to gain a law that does the least harm and the greatest good. You know, when you think about health care proposals and all the rest before Congress, that's a lot to pray for, isn't it? Let's pray for legislators and elected officials guided by God himself to do the least harm and the most good. Back with a conversation with Poe Bronson about raising our children. You won't want to miss it on the Albert Miller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. Poe Bronson is the author of the new book, Nurture Shock, along with Ashley Merriman. It's an important book, and if you've been reading my website and listening to this program for some time, you know the name Poe Bronson. He's been writing some amazing stuff. About children in particular, writing at New York Magazine. I read one of his articles on the problem of praise, and it caught my attention. He came on the program to talk about that. Now he's coming back to talk about Nurture Shock. Welcome, Poe Bronson, to the Albert Miller Program. Poe, thanks for coming.
Dr. Miller, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
This book is really getting a lot of attention. Congratulations. By the way, I just was in an airport, and there's the cover story, Newsweek Magazine. So you're getting a lot of traction with this.
I think that you were very helpful in that, Dr. Moeller, because you were one of the people who helped get the media's attention when I wrote the New York Magazine. New York Magazine isn't, you know, a huge publication like Newsweek, and I think it was people like you who helped spread the word and seed the market for us now. So thank you for that.
Well, glad to do it. And I'll tell you, I think the book is really important. It really pulls together a lot of what I've read and heard you talking about before, but in the covers of one book. Now, when you write a book like this, and the very title of it, Nurture Shock, it catches your attention. You're obviously talking about children. You're writing as a specialist and a researcher in the area of children and their behavior and their psychology. You're also the father of two younger children. So when you look at a book like this as Nurture Shock, you're really trying to shock parents, aren't you?
I suppose I'm trying to get their attention. And I think that there's a lot of hearsay and old disproven psychology out there that, you know, no generation of parents has been vulnerable to fads that have come along. And, you know, I would never establish any sort of dichotomy between science and faith. I think that some of the newest science has a lot of really good guidance about the moral development of children, about their honesty and their lying, their how to motivate them, how to handle it when you argue with them, and even sacred feelings, sacred emotions such as gratitude. And it's interesting that science is looking at these things and saying, well, here's what we found, not to order people what to do, not saying trust us. We wanted to lay it out there as a story and let people and let it guide them to make trust themselves ultimately.
You know, there are different ways to be shocked, and I think the most productive is to come across something that's just counterintuitive and yet research-based and just on its face makes sense when you first look at it. For instance, the very first thing I think that I saw you to have done was the article on the problem of praise, where you really talked about the fact that this whole self-esteem idea that is based upon just giving indiscriminate praise to children actually leads them to not only begin to disregard that kind of parental praise, but it becomes a disincentive to do that which is praiseworthy.
Right, they begin to, if they hear praise all the time, and they know darn well they maybe didn't deserve it some of the time, they begin to distrust that the praising person, be it a teacher or a parent, and they begin to feel less sincerity in the relationship. And that certainly is not a good thing. What's fascinating is that this goes all the way through their psychology to their neuroscience, to their brain, that in the reward center of our brain is a circuit that handles delayed gratification. And it's there to tell your brain, keep working. You know, even if we didn't make it this time, let's keep trying. You know, rewards are on the horizon. And that's literally a circuit that you learn to wire up in a kid's brain. And if you praise them all the time, their circuits don't learn to light up, don't learn to help through periods of difficulty, periods of failure, and periods where the praise isn't going to be there every day for them the instant they do something.
You know, the entire educational establishment has really reordered itself around this idea of self-esteem as being central to self-worth and the learning experience. And yet the research is indicating that that is not only unhelpful, it's positively, negative in terms of the effect on many children. And you wrote one thing in your book, and I had not seen this before, and it's a personal anecdote that you told about your own son. And the moment I read it, I said, you know, that's just exactly right. You spoke about your son, and you said that you knew that he would have to come to terms with his own intelligence. He would have to figure out how smart he is. And, you know, I read that and I thought, you know, he's going to do that anyway. Who right. do we as parents think we are to tell our children how smart they are? They're smart enough to figure out how smart they are. And if we're telling them something they know isn't true, that's not going to help.
That's exactly right, Dr. Miller. They're smart enough to see the pattern. And what the science says, kids have picked up on the fact that it's when a kid is falling behind that he receives or she receives the most praise from parents and teachers. Therefore, being praised isn't a sign, really, that you're doing well. It's a sign that your parents and teachers and community are worried about you. And only kids under age 7 today are taking praise at face value because they've heard so much insincere praise. And we need to scale back on the praise. Think about the kind of praise we give, especially praising their, just as you mentioned, their intelligence, their innate smartness. It teaches this idea that you either have it or you don't. And that works fine as long as things are going well, but the minute they hit difficulty, they're flipped onto the other side and they assume, I guess I don't have it.
I think the most fascinating area of research, just me personally, probably more as a theologian and pastor than even as parent, is what you've done online. We're going to get to that in just a moment. But from an educational perspective, I also have to tell you that this is not just about children. It's also about young adults. And as a seminary and college president and as a classroom teacher, semester by semester, I can tell you that the point you make on page 21 is exactly true. You're citing a teacher here who received a complaint from a parent. The parent said, you're destroying my child's self-esteem because the teacher had given her son a C. And the teacher said, your child is capable of better work. I'm not there to make you feel better. I'm there to make them do better. Speaking of the kids in the class, I can tell you that when I actually offer some helpful, intended to be helpful criticism about a student's work, they seem to respond to that even with greater self-esteem than if I told them, boy, that was a really good job, it was a really good paper. I'd have no earthly idea why you got a C.
You know, this interesting work by scholars is finding that kids interpret criticism as implicitly a sign that you know, the teacher thinks you can actually do better, which is actually a confidence-boosting thought. They're criticizing me not because they think I'm not good at it, but it's because they're criticizing me because they know I can do better. And so we've almost, with giving too much praise, we've reversed their meaning. Criticism now means confidence. Praising them now means a sign that you're lacking confidence in your child. And the right way to go back to this is restoring sincerity to our communication with our kids. One thing to give an honest compliment, and it's another thing to just sort of stop manipulating our kids' perceptions of what's going on.
You know, I think that gets back to the basic issue of honesty. And as parents, not only are we concerned about how honest our children are with us and to us, but as I read your book, it just reminded me of the importance of our honesty to our own children. And when it comes to an awful lot of this praise, children pretty much figure out that we're not telling them the truth, that we know something. And as you indicate in your book, what we know is that this is who they are. It's about the best they can do. If they either have it or do not have it, too much praise means you actually don't have it, because if you did have it, I wouldn't have to be loading you with all this praise. My guest today is Poe Bronson, the author of a very important new book, Nurture Shock. And I'll tell you, I just got off a plane a little bit ago, and it's in the airport bookstores. It's on the front cover of this week's Newsweek magazine. It ought to be on the Christian Parents bookshelf as well. When we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit more pointedly about why that is so. We're going to talk about why children lie. And yes, we are talking about your kids. Trust me. Some very interesting research on what's really going on there. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Miller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Poe Bronson writes for several periodicals. I see him most interestingly in New York Magazine, which I have to say, as a conservative Christian theologian, is a fascinating magazine because it deals with, of course, kind of the zeitgeist of what's going on in Manhattan. But beyond, it really deals with a lot of cultural issues that I find of tremendous significance. Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman are the co-authors of the new book, Nurture Shock. We've been talking with Poe Bronson about what is really going on with the whole self-esteem movement, and counterintuitively, what do we need to learn from the latest research, which I want to say as a Christian theologian, I think is very, very consistent with the biblical worldview to which we are accountable. I want to get to the lying issue, which I found most fascinating. But before I get there, Poe, I want to ask you, what is it about sleep? Because when I think about parents listening to this program, that might be the one most concrete thing they can deal with tonight.
Exactly. Parents may not realize this because when we were kids, we think we didn't get a lot of sleep. But the average child today is still getting an hour less than we got 30 years ago. The average high schooler is getting 6.65 hours of sleep per night. And it turns out that when you get less than, more than 7.5 hours, it's still not enough, but you don't suffer too much. But dip below 7.5, and you're seeing amazing cognitive deficits, hormone disruption during the nighttime, because there's 5 hormones that regulate obesity and appetite that all get disruptive. And it's during sleep that kids' brains are recoding memories. They take what they learn that day in short-term memory, and the brain puts it into long-term memory. And if you disrupt their sleep, they can't remember as much. And not only that, but they actually remember bad memories better than they remember good and pleasant memories. The result is you give them a disposition in which they lack their sunniness, and they were kind of able to recall all the bad things that have happened in their life.
It's interesting that I read your book about an hour after reading Andrew Sullivan's most recent piece on torture in the latest edition of The Atlantic. He makes the point that sleep deprivation is one of the cruelest forms of torture because it leads almost immediately to a form of psychological depression. And you're really indicating that the depression experienced by many children and adolescents could also be really due to, at least partially, a lack of sleep.
Right. This lost hour of sleep seems to have doubled the rate of depression in teenagers, and that many of the classic hallmark traits that we assign to adolescents, moodiness, temperamentalness, sluggishness, apathy, are actually also exactly the list of symptoms of chronic sleep deprivation. And I tell the story in the book, one anecdote of a mom who helped get her school district to start high school an hour later, to go back to the old time of starting at 8:30 or 8:40. And in her mind, she got her son back. He went from being this moody, impulsive, recalcitrant kid to the great kid he had always been before he started high school.
You know, one other very important part of your book has to do with the perception children have of race. And one of the points you make is that the idea that you can just put children in a racially diverse environment and they'll figure out that racism is bad just doesn't tend to turn out. That actually you're encouraging parents to speak very specifically about race and differences with very young children.
Yeah, and this was not easy for me, Dr. Mohler. I was one of the parents who believed that my child, certainly he sees skin color, but he would make nothing of it because he would see that we treated everybody equal, and he would, if he wasn't taught racism, it wouldn't exist. But the science says that what we're doing is only creating a vacuum. We're leaving kids to try to figure out what skin color means on their own. And you see these studies, these are out of the University of Colorado and been repeated at the University of Texas and other places, that show that at 6 months old, infants will stare longer at faces of other races because they're trying to figure out what it means. By the time they're 3 years old, if you hand them a deck of cards and you ask them to pick out their friends, 86% of kids will pick kids of their own skin color, their own race. By the time they're 4 or 5, if you just ask them to sort the deck into 2 piles, 68% will use race to sort the deck. Even if you didn't ask them to, you do it by race. And these are kids whose parents are very tolerant, very embracing of people, whatever culture or ethnicity they might have, and the parents were shocked to see their kids do this. And what that seems to be that when you talk openly about race with your children and you teach tolerance overtly, even to young kids, they don't make these mistakes.
You know, I was particularly touched in that chapter of your book by the necessity of parents speaking very specifically about race. In fact, you mentioned an anecdote in which a mom was speaking to her little boy, saying we treat all people equally, and she'd been doing so for some time, only to have him come up later and say, "Mommy, what's equal?" That kind of specificity turns out to be really, really important. Awkward as it might seem, it will really be helpful in engendering the right moral understandings in your own children. When we come back, we're going to talk about why children lie. Fascinating research. And Poe Bronson and his associates will be right back with the calls.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back. My conversation today is with Poe Bronson, the co-author of the book Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. He wrote the book along with Ashley Merriman. Perhaps you have seen some of his research. I've mentioned it quite often at my website at albertmohler.com. We've talked about it here on the program. Poe's been a guest before. And this new book is out. It's getting a lot of attention. It needs to. And I've been talking about getting to the issue of lying, because even as I had seen this research before, I'll tell you, it came back with a vengeance as I was reading this chapter of Nurture Shock. Now, but let me just put it to you this way. I think most parents are actually going to recognize their children in this chapter.
Oh, certainly. And that's what I'm hearing very much, is that they recognize that their kids experiment with lying around the time of their fourth birthday, or sometimes a little earlier than that. They might have thought that their kids will grow out of it. They kind of grow into it and seem to lie more for a couple of years. And they recognize, especially in their children, they're learning the habit of dealing with difficult circumstances by lying just to try to make people happy and make the problem go away. And it's a very unfortunate habit. Lying is normal to start, but then it's very important how we deal with it as parents and teachers, because if a kid is still lying when they're sort of 6 or 7 years old, then they tend to hang on to it as a habit for life. But if you can kind of condition it out of them in those early years, they seem to back away from it, at least until their teen years, where they might experiment with it again.
You know, you really struck me in your research here by demonstrating that even though the youngest children are motivated to lie by an attempt to avoid punishment for wrongdoing, as children get older, they tend actually to become far more sophisticated liars in order to really kind of lubricate relationships, including relationships with the parents. You know, amazingly enough, it doesn't take much reflection on your chapter to realize that oftentimes parents really incentivize lying to them, to themselves, because they would rather just be happy than have to deal with the reality.
Yeah, and we did some polling, Dr. Mohler, of parents on this issue, and we found that we gave them a very simple question. What do you think is going to get kids to lie less? Hearing the story of the boy who cried wolf, which is all about punishment for lying, or hearing the story of George Washington, cherry tree, which is all about love for a child that comes from honesty. And the vast majority of parents thought the boy who cried wolf was the way to go, that we need to make kids know that lying is wrong, you get punished for lying. But actually, when you tell that story to kids, and they do this in manipulated experiments, lying goes up and kids become better liars. What kids need to hear less of is that lying is so bad. They need to hear that honesty is good, and that they can please their parents, they can get back in their good graces, they can do the right thing by telling the truth. And I learned to apply this to my own daughter, and it was amazing to me how well it works. In a moment when she might lie to me because she's done something wrong and she wants to cover it up, I'll say to her, "Honey, I really want you to tell me the truth. You'll make me really happy. I'm offering her immunity, right? But and she will cough up the truth, and she'll admit what she did, and I give her a big hug, and she's getting the conditioning towards lying out of her at an early age."
It's a very, very interesting set of data. The overwhelming majority of children lie, and it's actually a sign of intelligence, because it actually takes some developed intelligence to lie. And, boy, I'll tell you, Poe, at least from my perspective, that just proves Genesis 3 all over again. I mean, the intelligence gives us the new avenue for being even more sophisticated in wrongdoing and now lying about it. Another thing that I found new in the book that I had not seen before in terms of your research has to do with something that has been one of my concerns for a long time. And I wish we could talk about so many things on the program. But with time running out, I want to ask you, why should we be concerned about bored adolescents?
Yeah, children and young teenagers who are bored turn more to drinking, drug use, and early sexual activity in order just basically to stimulate their brains. And this is a period of their development when they lack they have a deficit of neurotransmitters in the reward center of the brain, and they have a surplus of oxytocin in the amygdala of their brain, which makes them highly attuned to the feelings of their peers. And they can't get excited about just mild or moderate exciting things. They need to do something really risky or outrageous to sort of get a pulse in their brain. And teen boredom tracks to a lot of risk behavior that we certainly don't want kids to be doing.
Now, let me ask you about that. One of the questions I had as I read that section of your book is there an appreciable difference in the research between boys and girls in this regard?
In that particular research, there was not a dramatic difference between boys and girls. What you see is boys and girls reporting differently to the scholars. They'll talk differently about what their risk profile is. They'll report it differently, but when you look in their brains, you don't see dramatic differences there. And when you actually monitor boys actually can be even more sensitive to the thoughts and feelings of others around them and the implicit expectations, the peer pressure that they think they're hearing from people around them. But other than that, it seems to be true. It's what we see more is individual variation, that some kids are not as prone to risk and some kids are more prone to risk. And that sort of swamps out the boy-girl differences.
You know, another section that I thought was immediately applicable to parents as a warning is what you write on page 173 about teenagers and driving. You make the point that teenagers can score 100% on the written exam about driving rules. But when they actually get into the context of driving, they get more or less a brain overload, and they are unable to project ahead to the decisions that they, on paper, say they know they are to make. And then you make the point, you put a peer in that car, and it just gets all the more difficult.
That's exactly right. That kids' brains learn to anticipate. As grown-ups, we understand anticipation. And when you overload a kid in driving in a car, they can't anticipate. Therefore, they lead to a lot more accidents.
Incredible. And the research, by the way, in this book is the kind of thing that that is counterintuitive in terms of what certainly has been the main message of much contemporary culture in recent years. But it's also the kind of research that actually leads to some aha moments where parents can say, well, I really can make a difference. And for Christian parents, this is a lot of research that actually affirms what you already know and gives you some concrete applications as to how to make a difference in the lives of your own children. Poe Brosnan and Ashley Merriman, the authors of Nurture Shock, it's been an honor to have Poe Brosnan on the program today. We'll be right back with final thoughts on the Albert Miller Program. I really enjoyed having Poe Brosnan on the program today, and it was a good interview because we covered a waterfront, and I think it was also good because he really got to the very pointed issues I think would be most particularly helpful to parents. Speaking especially to Christian parents, let's be very clear. Our authority for parenting is not any contemporary author. It's not contemporary scientific research. It is certainly not the establishment of self-proclaimed experts about our children. It is the Bible is the Word of God. Our first concern is to be faithful to God's expectations of parents and God's conception of parenting, and that requires us to understand also a biblical conception of the child. And yet, when you look at a lot of the contemporary research, we need to be thankful for something. We need to be thankful that an awful lot of nonsense is being dispelled before our eyes. And especially over the last, say, 3 or 4 decades, the culture of the therapeutic has really produced a very warped and unhealthy understanding of the human being. Now, granted, a very secular understanding has been supplanted by a somewhat new secular understanding. But we need to be thankful when especially we see some of the lies and the misrepresentation, some of the myths, and just some of the bad thinking about parenting and about children being really erased before our eyes, even by research. We don't need to fear this, because let's remember that what we are looking at here, when this kind of research actually gets to the truth, and that's the same as if it was a matter of mere physiology, looking at the operation of the heart or the liver or any other part of the body. When we're talking about the brain, the neurological system, when that actually tells us the truth about the human being, we're being brought here face to face with what theologically we call common grace. This is the revelation of God in nature, the revelation of God, indeed, in our bodies, the revelation of God. By the way, how does that work? Well, the revelation of God's judgment in our bodies, you don't get very old till you start to see that in the mirror. And you know that's theologically significant. Well, an awful lot of the research that Probe Brosnan was talking about here, Bronson and Ashley Merriman, they were talking about stuff that when you take a closer look at it, you discover, you know, that really not only makes sense as a parent, that also makes sense from a biblical point of view. And much like when we are considering, you know, getting our children vaccinated because of an incipient illness and the threat of an illness, and when we consider the kind of health we want for our children, the kind of diet that we feed them, the kind of vitamins that we make sure they have, the right kind of nurturing environment that we know they need. When it comes to a lot of the issues that Probe Brosnan and Ashley Merriman discuss in Nurture Shock, you realize that parents need to give a whole lot more attention to questions such as this. Are we really encouraging our children to lie without thinking about it? Are we robbing our children of much that they need and of a real chance of academic success when, for instance, they just don't get enough sleep, even that one missing hour making a big difference? Big questions for us to answer, a lot for us to think about. Thanks for joining me today on the Albert Miller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.